Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. And this is Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods, who, rather than being on Vancouver Island, has graced us with his presence here in Studio B of CKVS. Hello, Tim. How are you doing today, and what is our topic?
Well, I am thrilled to be here with you, Steve, and today's topic is also one that I'm very excited about. It's the race to the moon. We're going to talk a little bit about it, but of course, most everyone has known quite a bit about and watched and read. So, Steve, we are going to look at a couple of aspects of the Apollo program and the race to the moon. One of them in the first half will be a look at the will to win. What was it that was driving the two sides that were prominent in that competition to get to the moon? And in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about a phenomenon that came to be known as Go Fever. But first, I thought we might warm up a little bit by talking about our own personal connections to the space program in terms of following it and watching along with the rest of humanity. For example, here's an obvious question. Do you remember where you were when you watched the lunar landing?
Absolutely, Tim. Although I had a TV set, and so did most of our friends. As a matter of fact, everyone had TV sets. It was decided that our local group of friends was going to meet at one particular person's house and stay up. He had a bigger TV set than what we did. It was in color. And although most of the images were in black and white, we were staying at a particular friend's house. And of interest, his dad watched it with us too. And one thing which kind of stood out for me was the pronunciation of the word vehicular. So we were watching Cronkite as announcing extravehicular activity and scratching our heads saying, well, isn't that, we call it a vehicle, not a vehicle, so wouldn't it be vehicular activity? So that was an interesting little earthy segue of watching this epic flight. And
Steve,
yourself?
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say you're the only person on planet Earth that remembers it as a conversation about the word vehicular. Is it possible? I think it is. But, you know, you mentioned the TV aspect. There were, it seems, 530 million people who tuned in on some kind of a TV. 1 in 7 humans on the planet. Pretty amazing share of the audience. Keeping in mind that although most of us had televisions, in many parts of the world, that just wasn't the case. I had hitchhiked from Toronto out to Edmonton to visit my brother, who was living and working in Edmonton. And he had rented a black and white television. And I remember being impressed by the fact that my older brother had his own place. And that there we were watching, apparently going to see this human step on the Earth, or on the moon, I should say. And, you know, a sense of disbelief was the prominent feeling I think I had that day.
Disbelief not only in the fact they're doing it, but the fact that it might work. When you consider the number of aircraft on any given day that would have a technical glitch and be delayed for half an hour or so on, and the millions of parts that went into the launch vehicle itself, it was absolutely amazing.
Well, the risks, the sense of foreboding that, and I mean, how many times did they tell us that there was a delay and that we were going to be seeing things that were happening a few seconds ago or whatever that number is, and the fear that something bad might already have happened. There was just so much to worry about and be afraid of, but on the other hand, as we saw, the success brought with it a tidal wave of excitement.
Well, despite this side of the story, there is the competition of ideologies and the competition between scientists and rocket scientists. You got one more side of the story you wanted to explore. What's that one all about?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Well, what we just heard there, Steve, of course, was the opening monologue of Star Trek, the original show, including Shatner saying, "Space, the final frontier." Now, that script was written by Gene Roddenberry, who I think most of us would know was the creator of the Star Trek franchise, and very much a fan of space exploration and a huge optimist. He had been a television writer and producer, but this would become, of course, his amazing debut with this show. And he is credited with creating the concept, the characters, the overall vision of Star Trek, and writing that iconic opening monologue. And the emphasis here is the final frontier. Why would you use that phraseology to describe a show about space travel? Well, for a very, very good reason. There is something known as the frontier thesis in American history. It dates all the way back to 1893, when a fellow named Frederick Jackson Turner wrote a very influential article called The Significance of the Frontier in American Society. So for Turner, we're talking here 1893, he had put his finger on the existence of a frontier in the American West as helping to define how Americans saw themselves. He argued in his thesis that this notion of the Wild West being tamed by civilized Americans from the eastern part of the continent was what defined the American character. And it was picked up again, time and again, right through till President Kennedy's campaign for the presidency in 1960, he would use references to the frontier, the new frontier, sailing the frontier, were a major part of his pitch to Americans that the things, the great ideas he had for a new future for America were rooted in the traditions of the frontier. And space was just one extension of the frontier that had been Texas and then California and so on. Space was now going to be the final frontier. And I've always been fascinated by how important that was and how you can hear references to it, the frontier, right through till to the current day. It wasn't long ago, Steve, that you and I were paying attention to the announcement of which astronauts would be on the next Artemis launch returning humans to the moon. And I believe the fellow's name is Bill Nelson, who's the head of the program. His job was to name the four astronauts that would be returning to the moon, including, of course, the Canadian. And in his reference, in his speech, which was relatively short and quite excellent, once again, he talked about the new frontier. It's a current that's been in American history, dating back, well, arguably to 1893 when this historian put his finger on it, but it still played a relevant role through the race to the moon. So, Steve, I wanted to note that when Kennedy made these speeches referencing the new frontier, he was drawing on one of the great speechwriters of all time. We all know so many of the amazing things that Kennedy, his quotes that have lived down through generations, those were typically written by a fellow named Teddy Sorensen. But maybe you can tell us more about how Kennedy tapped into that theme.
Well, yes, Kennedy, the 35th president of the state, used the word frontier in his promotion of the American space program. And in a speech at the joint session of Congress on May 25, 1961, he articulated the goal of sending humans to the moon and famously said, "I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out," although he said, pronounced it as decade, "of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. It will be an entire nation, for all of us must work to put him there." And while Kennedy did not specifically use the phrase "final frontier" in that speech, he conveyed the idea of space exploration as a new frontier for human exploration and progress, and presented it as a grand endeavor that required national effort and symbolized the frontier spirit of exploration and discovery that had characterized American history.
So we set that against we're talking about this will to win. Well, another significant part of the will to win was what, in fact, became known as the Cold War. And there were certainly a great many Americans of both political stripes, I presume even apolitical people, who had come to be extremely fearful of just what the Soviet Union and the Russians were up to, capable of, and what the future might hold. And the space race had become, or would become, a proxy for this competition. And I know, Steve, you've had a long-standing interest in the Cold War. You can certainly remind me and our listeners just how riveting that Cold War became in the lives of ordinary Americans and people around the world.
Well, right after the launch of Sputnik in October of 1957, on the very same day that Leave It to Beaver premiered on TV and the Afro Arrow was rolled out in Malton, Ontario, the Senator of Texas, Lyndon Johnson, said that soon that the Russians would be dropping bombs on us from space, like kids throwing rocks on cars, on overpasses on freeways. And in a recent video clip that I saw on TV, they were interviewing people in Times Square at that time, and one young woman said, "We're very fearful of the Russians doing these things in space. We have to get up there too." And so building upon this fear of the Russians, the Soviet Union, being in space ahead of them, drove the impetus for the Americans to get their rockets in space. Interestingly, Eisenhower, first of all, did not want to use military rockets, and so they lagged behind the Russians, who were using basically ICBM developments to put their first Sputnik in space, and indeed Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space. And it wasn't until Vanguard failed miserably on live TV that the decision was made to use Von Braun's Redstone rockets, which were a version of a military missile.
Well, the Americans found themselves technologically ahead of the Russians in every regard, except for the heavy lift capability that for some reason the Russians had been able to achieve a leadership there. And Kennedy wanted to know what he could do, what he could promise in the space race that Americans could win at. And he wasn't particularly interested in space. In fact, originally he had been somewhat skeptical and negative about money spent on anything to do with space exploration. The launch of Sputnik kind of changed that reality, I think. And so Kennedy asked his advisors and NASA, what is it that we could possibly promise to do that we could beat the Russians at? You know, sending up two astronauts, sending them up for a week, whatever. Come up, give me an idea. And he was told, where we've learned, that there really wasn't anything in the immediate future that would trump the Russian ability to get heavier objects circling the Earth.
Paradoxically, the Russians' ability to put heavy things in space was precipitated by the fact that their bombs were big ones. They just could not miniaturize them and make them lightweight. So knowing that they had this great heavy thing they hadn't put in space, they said, we must build big rockets, which they did, whereas the Americans had, relatively speaking, lightweight, equally powerful atomic bombs, which did not require great big engines.
It's interesting to how these happenstances, historical artifacts, would drive behavior. It makes obvious sense when you learn these background stories. And so that's why Kennedy would say, we're going to get to the moon first. He was told that's one competition we could probably win.
Right. And interestingly, and I just found this out recently, that the second stage engines for the Saturn rocket were simply scaled up versions of Wernher von Braun's V2 engines. They weren't really inventing anything from the get-go or anything new. And of course, von Braun was only one of a handful of German scientists that were brought over in Operation, what was it again?
Paperclip.
Operation Paperclip.
Well, I wanted to switch the page over to the Russian or Soviet Union side of this equation. And Nikita Khrushchev was the leader of the Soviet Union from 1953 to 1964. And it's important to note that he, in fact, was very supportive of the Soviet Union's lunar landing ambitions. And Khrushchev was known for his enthusiasm for space exploration and the advancements that were being made by their scientists and engineers. So he was kind of all in. Of course, he wasn't going to be there throughout the 60s. He came to lose his grip on power when Leonid Brezhnev and a number of the other communist leaders decided there was an opportunity to get rid of a fellow who'd become quite unpopular.
Strangely enough, very unpopular with the Soviet military. His emphasis on rockets was based mainly out of economics. It was cheaper to build a few rockets with hydrogen and atomic bombs than it was to sustain a great, large standing army. And so he scaled back on the army and the navy and built up the strategic rockets. And generals being what they were, they didn't like to see their manpower and their clout being cut. So when the Cuban Missile Crisis failed, well, it failed in one aspect but succeeded in another. It succeeded in the fact that his aim was to get rid of the Jupiter rockets that Kennedy had placed in Italy and in Turkey, which could very quickly reach the Soviet Union. So he just simply decided to place IRBM rockets in Cuba to show Kennedy what it was like. So he succeeded in the fact that secretly the Americans took those missiles out of Italy and Turkey. But on the face of things, it looked like he lost. But he also did gain a promise from the Americans they would never invade Cuba. But, as you say, Brezhnev and others got rid of him.
When Brezhnev and his team came in, they weren't as publicly committed to the space program. And, of course, revenue and money and investment and choices are always a factor in politics. And we now know that the Americans would spend something in the magnitude of $25 billion U.S. dollars, or about $153 billion in 2021 adjusted dollars, far more than the Russians. So the Americans were outspending the Russians, and there were problems with the Russian rockets that were being developed, the N1 and L3 program. They faced a lot of problems that they did not quite achieve. But in terms of that direct comparison, the Americans spent more than the Soviet Union, and they had a much larger budget, which allowed them to make more of the innovations that were necessary, despite the fact that ultimately the Russians would come very close. They were certainly not decades behind or even years behind. 1969, they were nearly there. So you've got this this will to win in both countries. You've got those differing reasons. You've got the politics, the leadership politics were in the Soviet Union. Khrushchev, when he left, it created a bit of a void in terms of the drive to win. But strangely enough, in the United States, we know how fractured their politics are today. But back in the 60s, both Republicans and Democrats, through the administrations of President Kennedy, President Johnson, and President Nixon, they all enjoyed bipartisan support for NASA's program and its commitment to go to the moon, which you have to say, how did they manage that? And it was a combination of factors. There was the great technological abilities of the United States. There was the fear of the Cold War and what the Russians might do. And there was the frontier thesis, where the American leadership political class had been able to tap into a historical current about what Americans could feel good about. And I think you have to give them, there is some significant credit that has to go to those politicians, I'd say. So, Steve, we've mentioned before the importance of the paperclip program and bringing in people like Wernher von Braun. But I'm a skill testing question for which I hope you're prepared. Who was the most senior ranking non-American that was a part of the NASA space program? You've got 5 seconds. Go.
Well, during the 60s, the most senior position held by a non-American citizen in the NASA space program was Dr. Kurt DeBuse. Dr. DeBuse played a crucial role in overseeing the development and operation of NASA's human spaceflight programs, and that included Mercury, Gemini, and the early Apollo missions. And as director, he was responsible for managing the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, which served as the launch site for the U.S.'s manned space missions.
So it's another example of the resources that were required, the kind of political will. You have to know that Dr. DeBuse was not, in fact, motivated by the frontier. I don't think he was even motivated by the Cold War. He was a scientist given an opportunity to do something significant, and he was very good at it. So there's our look at the will to win. And Steve, where are we at?
Well, it's interesting to take a look at Canada's contribution at the early stage of the will to win or whatever. So we were entitled to join along, tag along with the Americans, using an American ship as a booster. The Canadian angle was not as a final frontier, but we were indeed looking at our frontier in the sense that telecommunications, particularly to the north, were needed to be developed and improved upon, and in general, from a transcontinental point. And so this all led to our first Alouette satellite, and not only the satellite itself, but the aerials on that satellite, which were innovatively designed. So whereas most satellites used a long antenna that had to be folded in various sections, the Alouette satellite was more like the wrappings around a marking pencil. So it was very short and compact, but as it extended, it unraveled and unwound and could become quite large in a relatively compact state. And that kind of an innovative design in antennas was used on other spacecraft. So having demonstrated the Canadian innovation process and the ability to manufacture something in-house, shall we say, within the confines of Canada, we were invited by NASA to come up with a design for a robotic arm used on the International Space Shuttle. And of course, we all know that as the Canada arm.
So Avro Arrow may not have been our shining moment in terms of forming the base of a future aviation technology, but the example you just gave was. It was a demonstration of a certain kind of technological prowess.
Yes, it was. But also with the closing down of the Arrow project, any number of engineers went to NASA, and indeed one of the chief designers, or the chief designer for the two-man Gemini program, was a Canadian from the Avro program. And as well, the fly-by-wire system that was being used in the Avro era was used in Gemini and Mercury as well. And fly-by-wire meaning as you pull back on the stick, there is not actually a relay of levers and pulleys and bevels. It's a electronic device, so it measures a movement left, right, forward, and backwards, and you don't have to have cables and wires. So that was a demonstrated development in the Avro era.
Steve, the other half of the focus on the race to the moon for today's program is what became known as Go Fever, and the heritage of that term, to my knowledge, arose out of Apollo 1, which had the tragic fire on the launch pad. Things were pressing along at a good pace. Americans were achieving great success with the Mercury and Gemini programs. They were gearing up for the launch of their Apollo initiative with three astronauts and the capability of getting to the moon. But then, as we now know, there was a tragic fire that took the lives of the three astronauts that were training aboard, and it was due to the use of 100% pure oxygen in the capsule as it sat on the ground in Cape Canaveral. An electronic spark of some sort took place, and in that atmosphere of 100% oxygen, the fire just lit up as a candle, you might say, and there was no chance for those astronauts or anyone else to rescue them.
All right, there were a number of technological problems with that particular spacecraft. For example, the door, the escape hatch, swung inwards. And so therefore, if you have a high buildup of pressure in the inside, it was impossible for them to push that door open from the outside. So in the redesign process, not only did they not use 100% oxygen, but the escape hatch opened outwards. And there were a number of other factors, such as using totally non-inflammable materials to cover wires and so on. So the go fever in trying to very quickly produce an Apollo 1 capsule resulted in those three deaths. And as we mentioned in another episode, Leonid Brezhnev had go fever for the 150th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, which led to the early deployment of the Soyuz 1 spacecraft and the death of the cosmonaut Komarov in space. And as a matter of fact, Tim, I've just come across a recent recording of his last death words as he's plummeting wildly through the upper edges of space to his death, and he is very upset with the engineers and the decision to go ahead with his flight. Let's have a listen.
that is a tragic story and the loss of life. What happened at the time, however, was this general realization that something truly amiss had gone wrong, and it wasn't just that spark. They knew that there must be a deeper underlying set of reasons or causes that had allowed this tragedy to take place on the launch pad. And they would have to put the entire Apollo program on hold because they had no idea just how deep the rot might have gotten. They had to say, tools down. We've only got 2 years to go before we're hoping to get to the moon. But we now know that something has gone horribly wrong, not just on that launch pad. And in their homework, in their investigations, which I think was quite thorough as far as I've ever read, quite commendable, at some point, some bright lad observed that the problem, the deepest problem they had, was what he called go fever.
That kind of go fever was prevalent during World War II with the very rapid advancement of aerodynamics, engines, radars, which had a war not been going on and greater safety measures employed, then those developments would have happened on a much longer time basis. For example, the Hawker Typhoon aircraft, of the first 12 that were in developmental stages, 8 crashed. That's 75% crash rate. And yet, the Hawker Typhoon became the most dependable, most reliable, most effective ground attack fighter after D-Day. So it was absolutely necessary. Many people lost their lives in its development, but it was a hot war. Now we're talking about a cold war and the rocket developments, and there was go fever there too. But as you write, Tim, Frank Borman headed the Apollo 1 fire disaster, and they said, you have to scale back, slow down.
It's incredible when you think that Frank Borman would find himself on Apollo 8 not that long, a year and a half later.
Going around the moon
in December of 1968. So the process of getting to the moon took a detour in 1967 that the Americans were able to reason their way back from, which is a credit to them.
And speaking of frontiers, at this point, the Russians realized, the Soviet Union, that they couldn't beat the Americans to the moon. So their frontier went to Mars and Venus. And to this day, no one has explored Venus's surface better or other than the Soviets.
Tip of the cap. Steve, that's all the time we have for today's show about the race to the moon.
And go fever.
This is Tim Woods and
Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me